You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Becoming AOC, by Michelle Ruiz. My interviews with Ocasio-Cortez came at a precarious moment in history, before Election Day 2020, during a series of news cycles that are stunning, even by Trumpian standards. When we first sat down in her Bronx office, the New York Times had just published its bombshell investigation of Trump's taxes. Talking about it winds up Ocasio-Cortez, her tie-dyed mask pulled down to eat a sandwich. These are the same people saying that we can't have tuition-free public colleges because there's no money, she says, when these MFs are only paying $750 a year in taxes. Within a week, Trump was in the hospital with COVID-19, and Mitch McConnell was plowing ahead with Amy Coney Barrett's hearings. Next photo, A Bronx Tale. Ocasio-Cortez photographed with residents in her original borough on the corner of Kruger and Bronxdale Avenues. Trump is the racist visionary, AOC says. But McConnell gets the job done. He doesn't do anything without Trump's blessing. Trump says jump. McConnell says how high. Trump never does what McConnell says. The country may or may not have a new president by the time you hold this issue. This is not about a decision between two candidates, Ocasio-Cortez says solemnly. It's about a decision between two countries. A Biden win gives her district, which is dominantly made of Latinx, Asian, and Black people, and had been the epicenter of the pandemic, a fighting chance. If it's Trump, I cannot honestly look them in the eye and tell them that they will be safe. To that end, AOC spends the final days of October drumming up blue notes by playing Among Us with supporters online, while more than 400,000 people watch via the live stream platform Twitch, demonstrating yet again that she is the party's singular communicator. But the ending of this story is the same, no matter which man has won. America is still in a lot of trouble, warns AOC. There is a temptation to view Trump as an aberration, she says, rather than a wake-up call to failures of American government at large. Under a President Biden, if his life doesn't feel different, she points to a cab driver whizzing by our table. If their life doesn't feel different, she gestures to people walking by the beauty shop and Bengali Halal grocery. If these people's lives don't actually feel different, now she is giving a stump speech over her omelet. We're done. You know how many Trumps there are in waiting? She is tired of incremental change, of bullshit little 10% tax cuts, she says. I think, honestly, a lot of my dissent within the Democratic Party comes from my lived experience. It's not just that we can be better, it's that we have to be better. We're not good enough right now. A new crop of AOCs is popping up across the country. Young, progressive, working-class candidates of color who sought seats of power by her example. I wouldn't have run for office if it weren't for AOC and the squad, says Jamal Bowman, a former New York City principal. Of the many knocks on Ocasio-Cortez, one of the most prevailing is that she drives the political conversation but lacks a substantive coalition in Congress. They are four people, And that's how many votes they got, Pelosi once quipped, of the squad. But the potential addition of Bowman, fellow New Yorker Mondaire Jones, Cori Bush from Missouri, and Marie Newman of Illinois to the House would mean the squad just doubled up, Bowman says. Ocasio-Cortez gets animated as she imagines the rest of this squad plus. Nebraska's Kara Eastman and current Illinois Representative Chuy Garcia, with Sanders, Warren, and Ed Markey, Theo Markey, as Senate allies. You keep telling me I'm just four votes, AOC says, so I'm a go get more. Elon Musk, totally awful, batshit crazy, completely bonkers, most excellent year. In 2020, the COVID-doubting, media-hating, Twitter-holic CEO became the third richest man alive. SpaceX launched two astronauts into orbit, and Tesla became the most valuable car company on the planet. Nick Bilton gets inside the mind of Silicon Valley's most vainglorious villain. Opening illustration by Peter Horvath, which shows Elon Musk wearing a suit, arms crossed, planets in the background, rockets, cars, trucks, music, stars. Elon Musk is on a mission. He's on a mission to Mars. He's on a mission to save humanity from its reliance on fossil fuels, which could destroy the planet and kill us all. He's on a mission to save us from artificial intelligence algorithms going rogue and machines ending human life as we know it. He's on a mission to help save a group of boys trapped underground in Thailand. A mission to transport people from Los Angeles to San Francisco in giant air tubes. A mission to build ventilators for hamstrung hospitals during the coronavirus pandemic. He's on a mission to prove the coronavirus fatality rate is greatly overstated. To dig tunnels underground to alleviate the fatuous cycle of traffic jams. To save journalism. To mitigate the effects of climate change. To transport people in earthbound rockets from one continent to the next in mere minutes. To inhabit other planets before the sun explodes and turns our oceans into boiling vats of water, our skies into steam-filled death, our lands into carbon crust of darkness. He's on a mission to inhabit other star systems. All of these missions are completely possible in the realm of physics and science. Especially with Elon Musk's brain working to solve these problems. But this year, Musk set off on the most difficult mission of all. An expedition that has nothing to do with space, or fossil fuels, or coronavirus, or saving the lives of 7.7 billion people. And yet this new mission, unlike the long list of other tasks he plans to accomplish in his lifetime, is one that he may not be able to see through. A mission that, perhaps, no one of his stature has ever been able to accomplish. One that plagued Steve Jobs before he died. One that still afflicts Jack Dorsey each day. A mission that has sickened men and women since the dawn of modern civilization, kings, queens, business leaders, and politicians alike. A mission that may prove to be the most difficult one of his entire life. Elon Musk is on a mission to stop giving a shit what people think of him. Anyone who has paid even the slightest notice to Musk and his career over the past three decades, a series of vocations that would be almost impossible not to notice, is acutely aware that the 49-year-old entrepreneur, car maker, and rocket scientist is arguably one of the most capable CEOs on the planet, and is not merely changing the world, but the very fabric of the universe. He started the most successful private rocket company in history, and the most successful car company in the world, as well as a controversial solar provider. Lately, he has been building tunnels under Las Vegas to alleviate traffic and exploring doing the same in Los Angeles, Baltimore, and Chicago, while overseeing Neuralink, a company that wants to eventually plant computer chips in our brains, and recording a rap song that now has millions of listens. When I spoke to more than a dozen people who know him, both personally and professionally, irrelevant of whether they love him or hate him or both, most described Musk as a true genius. One simply said, "I've worked all over Silicon Valley with some of the brightest minds in the world, and there's only one person I would consider a true genius, who is head and shoulders the smartest guy in the room, and that is Elon." In addition to his superhuman abilities, Musk is an excellent father, according to some close to him, and the third richest person on the planet, worth around $108 billion as of October. As a result, he has been on the cover of almost every mainstream magazine in the world, including Wired, Time, The Atlantic, Newsweek, Fortune, Rolling Stone, and even Edibles magazine. Yet over the past year, a man who has done all of this before he has even turned 50 seems pained, like something has been gnawing away at him. At times, he even seems like he's on the edge of madness. An artist, moments away from cutting off his own ear and dropping it in a mailbox, or perhaps posting a picture of it on Twitter. To us mere mortals, this seems strange, given that in 2020, the darkest year in modern history, Musk has accomplished more than almost any of us will achieve in our lifetimes. And yet, even as he is making good on his promises to deliver us from ourselves, his mission to do the same for himself is proving to be far more difficult. Every culture and every era in time has its legends. The Chinese praised the great warriors and warlords who controlled the Asian Empire. The Polynesians worshipped the gods who supplied them with fish. In Europe, those who set off to find new lands were knighted and had entire armadas named after them. Yet in the relatively infantile United States of America, folklore and luminescence has bounced from one type of deity or false idol to the next. Politicians, once respected for changing the tides of society by beating back the axis of evil, are now mostly parodies of reality TV. Bankers, once idolized for their wealth, are now vilified and detested by the proletariat. Journalists with last names like Cronkite and Gellhorn have seen their professions bastardized by Hannitys and Ingrams. As of late, the most idolized in America have become the ones who are now partially destroying it, the tech titans. One by one, they've been built up as gods among us. Steve Jobs, Sergey Brin, Marissa Mayer, and Jeff Bezos, to name a few, had virtual statues of them erected in digital squares, which were then systematically spray-painted, dismantled, and tossed over a bridge as their true dualities came to light. This year, it seems, it was Musk's turn. At the forefront of the ire against Musk was his attempt to disprove the severity of the coronavirus at the height of the pandemic by downplaying the number of deaths and railing against America's decision to go into lockdown. This is partially, of course, due to the fact that shelter-in-place orders shuttered Musk Tesla factory right when it was getting into a production groove. But his puerile approach to disagreeing with the response to COVID-19 and his disregard and denigration of true experts aligned him with Donald Trump and his alt-right supporters, making Musk a pariah to the other half of the country that once revered him. On a Tesla earnings call, Musk stoked the fires, calling the shelter-in-place orders fascist and not democratic. He told the bro-friendly Joe Rogan that the actual mortality rate from coronavirus differed from projections by at least a factor of 10, maybe a factor of 50, a statement that is completely fabricated. But while Musk was playing the coronavirus skeptic in public, things were playing out differently in private. One person confided that Musk told them he was canceling trips to Asia due to COVID concerns. By May, seemingly fed up with Musk antics, the tide seemed to change enough that supporting him was akin to supporting Trump. This was exemplified when former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Preet Bharara, tweeted, "It feels good to unfollow Elon Musk." The turn from Musk, savior of the human race, to "What the F is wrong with Elon Musk?" a question that is constantly posed to me, began back in 2018 in what people internally at Tesla and SpaceX refer to as the summer of 420, according to two former executives. Musk, at the time, was constantly irked by the fact that Wall Street was shorting Tesla stock by more than $250 million, with more people betting against Tesla, and in turn, Musk, than any other company in the United States. According to financial technology and analytics firm S3 Partners LLC. Over the years, covering Musk and his companies, numerous employees have told me Musk sees the shorting of his stock as especially egregious. Given that Tesla is trying to help save the planet by ending our reliance on fossil fuels. As the story now goes, on August 7th of that year, while driving to the airport, Musk tweeted, "I'm considering taking Tesla private at $420, funding secured." Indeed, that turned out to be untrue. The number 420, a weed reference, was chosen as a joke. Less than a month earlier, he had called a cave rescuer in Thailand "pedo guy" and was becoming increasingly erratic on earnings calls, on social media, and in interviews. By September, he got high and drunk, or at least tipsy on the Joe Rogan Experience, smoking a joint and drinking whiskey. To everyone watching, it seemed as if Musk was finally unraveling from the pressure of his mission to save the world. The thing about Elon is that right now, everyone else is finally seeing the way he has always been, said a former Tesla executive who worked with Musk for years. He's being the same Elon he has always been in private. Now, this past year, he's just being Elon a lot more publicly. Some people close to him believe his erratic behavior in 2020 was even more on display because he has taken to substances, including alcohol and marijuana, which he obsesses about on social media, or LSD, as the singer Azalea Banks has claimed, and Musk has denied, or Ambien, which the board of Tesla has reportedly worried over. Whatever his drug of choice, several executives have told me that employees at all of his companies check Musk's Twitter account first thing in the morning to see what disaster happened the night before, and to decipher if it will lead to a new lawsuit, affect Tesla's stock price, or add to growing public resentment toward their CEO. We all wake up and look at it every day thinking, "Oh God, now what?" "You really had no idea what you were going to see," one former employee said. At SpaceX and Tesla, another Tesla executive told me, employees from both companies keep one another abreast of Musk moods, so they'll know if Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde is coming into the office that day. On SpaceX launch days, you have everyone at Tesla tuned in to see if the launch is successful. Not because we are vested in the rockets, but because it directly impacts Elon's mood for the next few days, the Tesla executive told me. If there was a failure on a launch, there'd be hell to pay. You didn't want to have a phone call set up with Elon afterward. On the other hand, if the rocket launch was successful, Musk's inbox would fill with budget requests. The same is true for SpaceX employees when new production numbers are set to be released for Tesla. In the past, Musk ire outside his companies was usually pointed toward authority, for which he has little patience and disregards, as if the world we live in and the rules that govern it don't apply to him and his companies. Musk simply hung up on the National Transportation Safety Board chairman when discussing a fatal Tesla autopilot accident. On earnings calls this year, he has constantly interrupted analysts. After his debacle in the summer of 420, he was charged with fraud by the SEC, but couldn't leave it alone and referred to the agency as the Short Seller Enrichment Commission. Musk eventually settled with the SEC, agreeing to step down as Tesla's chairman and pay $40 million in penalties. By spring of this year, when shelter-in-place orders were issued in Alameda County, where Musk Tesla Fremont plant is located, he refused to send employees home. After finally relenting, he went on a Twitter tirade, threatening to sue the county and even to leave California altogether before he got his way and the plant was reopened. This wayward behavior is on display in his personal life, too. According to one person who witnessed an argument between Musk and a former girlfriend upon leaving a club one evening, Musk aggressively railed against her, asking why she had hair on her face, referring to the slight peach fuzz that everyone has, visible under the bright light of the club's awnings. "Because I'm a mammal," the girlfriend replied, which only pissed Musk off even more. "There is a high level of degenerate behavior with Elon," one person who knows Musk told me. "There's a paranoia. Are you with me or against me?" "Musk hyper energy is sometimes uncomfortable to be around," this person added. "I genuinely want to leave the room sometimes when he walks in." And while he can even come across as a bully, they noted that Musk is not alone among tech titans in this character trait. "All of these guys, I've spent time with them. Musk, Zuck, all of them, they all exhibit tendencies of total and complete pathological sociopathy. They don't at their core give a flying F about you or me as individuals. They do, however, all seem to give a shit what people think of them. Usually when the tides of praise turn against someone of such stature, they hire consultants, lobbyists, and public relations firms to get them puff pieces in national news outlets, or they agree to give talks at major tech conferences, as long as the questions are little bitty softballs. Most of these CEOs and tech leaders are so obsessed with their image that they employ armies of communications experts who help craft their brilliance for all to see. Executives I've covered in Silicon Valley almost always have teams prep them for interviews with long lists of all the possible questions they might be asked and a long list of highly scrutinized answers. Yet after the summer of 420, Musk has taken on a completely different approach, one that is unlike anyone else at his level, and one that, some argue, is working out better than he ever could have imagined. The afternoon of December 6, 2019, was one of the most defining moments in Musk's decades-long career, according to several people close to him. It wasn't one of his most daunting missions in space, or yet another impregnable project with electric cars or brain implants or underground tunnels. Rather, it was a mission involving, what else? A tweet. Musk had spent the previous year and a half trying to, at times, rewrite the reasoning for his tweet accusing a British cave explorer who had helped rescue a dozen boys trapped in a Thai cave of being a pedophile. At other times, Musk had tried to justify the tweet's existence. The whole debacle culminated in a lawsuit by the cave explorer, Vernon Unsworth, and that afternoon in 2019, a verdict was due as to whether Musk should pay Unsworth damages and, more importantly to the billionaire, be perceived as being wrong. Musk was surrounded by his personal security guards as he set off to the U.S. District Courthouse in Los Angeles. Most people on the periphery of the case had assumed Musk would surely lose. But his luck, or money, given the price tag of the law firm Musk used to defend his tweet, would have it, he ended up winning. As he walked out of the courthouse, clearly relieved, having completed yet another mission, he told a gaggle of reporters, "My faith in humanity is restored." And then he did something completely out of the ordinary. Musk went to Twitter and started blocking many of the reporters who had covered the trial or who covered his companies, including Ryan Mack of BuzzFeed, Laura Kolodny of CNBC, and Dana Hull, who covers Tesla and SpaceX for Bloomberg, a move that no other CEO of a Fortune 500 company is known to have made. According to one person who worked with Musk through this whole escapade, he decided shortly after he won the case that he was finished trying to be nice to the journalist, seeing them as biased against him. How very Trump of him. What's more, he decided he was done being nice to anyone else who didn't agree with him. He had spent his entire career trying to pretend he gave a shit about what people thought of him, and he was done. He soon parted ways with a public relations firm he worked with. He didn't fill positions in his communications division when people left. And, as this person said, Elon is his own communications director now. When reached for comment on this article, he responded, "Vanity Fair sucks," attributing the quote very clearly to himself. Over the years, Musk has sometimes attacked the credibility of journalists, but as 2020 wore on, he went even further. He started to take on some of Trump's tricks with the media, saying things publicly like, "The Onion may be the best mainstream media source." And in the same way that Trump soured on CNN and mostly only shared news clips from Fox News and then soured on Fox News, only sharing clips from even more conservative outlets like One America News Network, Musk almost exclusively tweets links to heavily pro-Tesla websites like Teslarati, which often read more like a press release from Tesla than journalism. And like Trump, Musk loves to throw digital Molotov cocktails on the internet. He went from aiming to be on the cover of magazines to help his business grow to giving the middle finger to every mainstream news outlet who didn't parrot his vision of the world. On Twitter, he seemed to just want to be himself more, too. At times on social media, Musk seems sane and collected, sharing tidbits about science and climate change. At other times, he is erratic and irrational, tweeting things that seem to coddle the alt-right, men's rights activist, and random conspiracy theorist. As his attacks against the conventional wisdom around coronavirus wore on earlier in the year, Musk ignored those who tried to point out how his understanding of COVID-19 was blatantly incorrect and how deadly the disease really is. The new Elon Musk didn't care. Like a child covering his ears and yelling la 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 la, he simply didn't want to hear it. While Twitter has proven to be a hotbed of chaos for Musk, during certain times of the year, his habits on the platform played out like a Shakespearean drama. In the first week of June, for example, shortly after he and his girlfriend, the artist and singer Grimes, had their baby, Musk began following his ex-wife, Justine Musk, then followed his other ex-wife, Tallulah Riley. They were married and divorced twice. and bizarrely, a few days later, unfollowed Grimes before refollowing her again hours later. When Grimes later shared a thoughtful 274-character explanation of the name of their first child, XAEA12, a translation which includes references to Elven spelling, the unknown variable of the letter X, emojis of swords, a metal rat, and the SR-17 aircraft, Musk publicly responded that she had made a mistake, and the plane was actually an SR-71. "I am recovering from surgery and barely alive, so may my typos be forgiven, but damn it," Grimes responded. That was meant to be profound, followed, of course, by a hedgehog emoji. Many people I've spoken to who have worked with Musk in the past or are close to him have pointed out that from a financial and corporate perspective, Musk's mission to block his detractors and to not care what others think of him, to be himself, jerk or otherwise, is working better than he or anyone around him could have imagined. This past year, Musk successfully launched two astronauts into orbit from the United States, the first in almost a decade. Tesla became the most valuable car company on the planet in July, and Musk is working toward implanting chips into people's brains. Tesla also seemed poised to be inducted into the S&P 500, but a variety of factors, including Musk stock options, may have impeded it from making the cut. When I started reporting this story earlier this summer, Musk was worth half of what he is today, and while he's disliked by the left, he is still idolized among the technorati. While it appears that Musk's mission to say and do whatever he wants without caring about the results has worked out financially, there is another side to the story that those close to him, and especially Musk himself, are acutely aware of. Since around the summer of 420, Musk has lost more than 24 executives at Tesla, including 3 different general counsels, his director of engineering, director of sales, directors of finance, operations, accounting, production, and recruiting. His chief of staff, Sam Teller, who helped advise Musk with all things related to SpaceX, Tesla, and the Boring Company, also left after 5 years at Musk's side. One of those former executives told me there were times Musk would say or tweet something that was just too embarrassing to even try to defend. Which brings us to the great irony of Elon Musk and his endless missions. They all have a duality to them, and Musk seems able to see only one side of the equation. His mission to colonize Mars, for example, is one that he envisions will save humanity, given that we will likely destroy Earth through climate change or artificial intelligence or some other cataclysmically awful human-inspired event. According to all the people I spoke to for this article, Musk thinks starting over somewhere else will give us an opportunity to do things better next time. He genuinely believes that he can build enough rockets that we could see 1 million people living on the red planet by 2050. But when we eventually end up on another planet, humanity is most likely to do there what we've done here, destroy whatever wonder we have built. Nowhere is that more on display than with Musk himself. Humans are capable of great things. Every once in a while, a human comes along and propels us forward by leaps and bounds. A human like Musk. But at the same time, those humans are imperfect, even if we don't want them to be. They are flawed. They are not perfect. They are absolute extremes of themselves, explained one of Musk's former executives. If we end up on Mars, Musk will be there too, and he will bring his extremes with him. People will still disagree with each other. They will still argue about the way that world should be. If Twitter works on the red planet, Musk will still be blocking people who don't agree with him. And his own personality defects won't be left here on Earth. Musk, at times, can even acknowledge this himself. One former employee told me that once this person asked Musk if he ever worried about losing his mind. Musk replied, "Does a crazy person ever look in the mirror and know that he's crazy?" Perhaps this is really the most important mission Musk is on, to never have to answer that question. Now, this Vanity Fair Spotlight, The Long Way Home. In 2018, Chloe Zhao's The Rider was one of Barack Obama's favorite movies. Now the filmmaker is an Oscar favorite for The Transcendent Nomadland, about the search for work, peace, and self, by Sandy Tan, with opening photograph by Tierney Giron. California Dreaming, Chloe Zhao photographed at her home for Vanity Fair. And she sits in the chicken coop holding a hen. Not so long ago, Chloe Zhao was running back and forth from one end of the empty Disney lot to the other. She'd work on the sound mix for Nomadland, then dash off to edit Eternals. Yet what struck the 38-year-old filmmaker as surreal wasn't that she was making an art film and a globally anticipated tentpole at the same time. It was that the squirrels of Disney were starving. Usually, people at lunchtime are feeding all the squirrels, says Zhao, and now the squirrels are like, where did all the people go? These days, during the most high-flying year of her professional life, the director has been grounded. No jaunt to the Venice International Film Festival, where her movie Nomadland took the top prize. No trip to Toronto, where it won the People's Choice Award. The pandemic has kept the self-described nomad at home in Southern California with her partner, their mutts, Taco and Rooster, and three chickens, Red, Sebi, and Lucille. Zhao says she's been cooking, cleaning, and avoiding the treadmill in the corner. When she protests, "I love being at home," I'm only half convinced. But maybe Zhao is getting used to staying put after making three films in 3 years, including 5 months in her Ford Transit van shooting Nomadland across 5 states. "I have a tendency to dive in and then splash and find my way when I'm in the water," she says, describing both the way she makes her films and the way she lives. "You always want to chase that horizon." Growing up in Beijing, Zhao dreamed of England. When she enrolled at boarding school in England, she yearned for New York. And when she was at film school in New York, she fell hard for the South Dakota landscape she saw in National Geographic, which led her to the Native American reservation, where she shot her first movie, 2015's Songs My Brother Taught Me. "I've always been an outsider," she says. "I'm drawn to outsiders." Zhao has built her career by gravitating toward good stories, whatever and wherever they may be, and ignoring the bullying edict that artists should stick to subjects close to them. "I admire how, as a filmmaker, she transcends her own identity," says Sundance Film Festival Director of Programming Kim Yutani, who was part of the team that programmed Songs and gave Zhao her first break. In 2018's The Rider, which she self-financed for $80,000, Zhao cast a rodeo rider reckoning with a head injury as a rodeo rider doing the same. When she showed him training wild horses, he was doing it for real, with the horses bucking for real. The result was electric. In her hands, a cowboy at a crossroads turned into a mythic figure, and the film became an art house hit, as well as one of Barack Obama's favorite movies of the year, with critics raving that she had reinvented the Western. The Rider caught Frances McDormand's eye at a film festival and convinced her that Zhao would be the perfect person to direct the adaptation of a nonfiction book that she and producer Peter Spears had optioned, Jessica Bruder's Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. The partnership proved to be kismet. "She was wearing overalls when I saw her in her apartment in L.A., Zhao says of her first meeting with McDormand. "I thought, I like people who wear overalls. And of course, she's funny and down to earth." Like McDormand, Zhao is herself beloved in the indie film community for not having airs. She does photo shoots wearing next to no makeup, and showed up for a virtual Q&A for the Toronto Festival in a Hogwarts long-sleeve tee. "I haven't been to the hair salon in 5 years," the director says, of the lustrous mane she often wears in one unfussy braid. I'm a true believer that you have to work with people who are on the same page with you, not only about the film, but about how to be in the world. Otherwise, the drama is just going to be endless. Friend and I spend a lot of time getting to know each other, and we do have a lot in common. With Nomadland, Zhao's method of fusing fact and fiction reaches its zenith. McDormand and David Strathairn lead a cast of real-life nomads who, despite being non-actors, give some of the year's most moving performances. McDormand, too, is at the top of her game, and a top contender for the Best Actress Oscar as Fern, the fictional Nevada widow she created with Zhao to act as our guide into the world of van-dwelling Americans in search of seasonal work. To achieve Zhao's mode of intimate realism, she and McDormand handpicked a relatively small crew and embarked on an ambitious weather-based shoot that was a feat of logistics. Zhao wanted to capture the four seasons while also cataloging the major types of landscapes of the American West, from redwood forest to desert to the Badlands. On top of that, they had to cast the real-life nomads who would play themselves on screen and accommodate their schedules and locations. Zhao traveled to meet her nomads where they lived, whether it was the Nevada desert or the parking lot of a Planet Fitness in Colorado. "When working with non-actors," she says, "it's not so much the directing that's different, but the writing. You've got to get to know them really well, and then you've got to write for them." On Nomadland, she rewrote scenes every day, depending on what the weather and the performers brought. "Chloe has an enormous capacity for people and their stories," says her partner Joshua James Richards, who has also been her director of photography since Songs. When the couple first met as NYU film students in 2012, Zhao sat him down and made him tell her everything about growing up in a little fishing town in Cornwall, England. She has a way of making your story feel important and special. McDormand, who is a producer on the film, hadn't intended to act in Nomadland, but Zhao was enough of a realist to know that a quiet film populated by non-professionals might need an incredible actress with a strong presence to be the audience's anchor. Fern, like the director herself, is a listener. With her eyes, she takes in her fellow travelers, mostly older people who simply cannot afford to retire, and in a shifting array of smiles, conveys a deep well of joy, pain, wonder, and realignment. "That's the genius of Frances McDormand," says Zhao. She insists that she had no part in shaping her star's performance, though she also wrote the screenplay and edited the film. "Most of McDormand's scenes," she says, "were captured in a single take, even as she had to react to the varying abilities of her non-professional co-stars." Having Fran as a collaborator is incredible, because she's able to adjust on the spot with me. Within the first 10 minutes of the film, Fern takes us inside an actual Amazon fulfillment center, a whale belly of a warehouse with an oceanic roar so constant we can feel our bones rattle. It's work that Fern will later describe without irony as great money, which says as much about her situation and our messed up economy as a whole documentary packed with outrage. Back in China, Zhao was the outcast, the weirdo, obsessed with the Mongolian plains. At boarding school, she was the kid in the library. Now that she's part of the conformist film industry, as she puts it, I love being reminded that there are other ways to live. While she's too busy finishing up Eternals to plan a new project, she hopes to replicate her gutsy system of making a smaller and a bigger movie in tandem, because each movie keeps the other in check. She names Alfonso Cuarón as the director with the kind of range she aspires to. Do I want to go back and make a film with even less budget than the writer? 100%. If the right story presents itself. Would she make a movie set in China? Sure, if the right story came along. Her parents, whom she calls her best friends, still live in Beijing, as does the 98-year-old grandmother she's very fond of. They keep in touch via WeChat. As an only child, Zhao is thankful that unlike many Chinese of her generation, she wasn't spoiled by them. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.